Then you throw in some tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do it boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? Add a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Do you want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Hope you've had a good weekend out and about enjoying the weather, enjoying spring harvest. Have you had fava beans yet? I need some. Our guest tonight, I just saw last night at the grand opening of his store in the Barlow, second business to open to the public in that big development. It is Ben Kidmunt, returning for at least a second, maybe a third visit to Mouthful.
Third.
Yeah. That's right. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I realize I don't know what you're calling the store.
It's just called Ben Kidmunt Bookseller.
Oh, and that was my guess. I would have been right.
Yes.
And you are... What's the right way? Antiquarian isn't the right...
No, that's correct, yeah.
Oh, it is.
An antiquarian bookseller.
Yeah. And you specialize in gastronomy, yeah. Agriculture, gardening, landscaping?
And also some books on perfume.
That's right.
Perfume. And domestic economy in general. So.
That's right. I've got to get you together with my daughter. She's an academic and moves in part of that arena. Oh, okay. She will just go insane in your store. So you move to a place where people can just come in, not make an appointment?
Well, in fact, the shop, as you know, the Barlow is just beginning and only a couple of us have opened. And so we're kind of trying to wait and see what the flow is like.
Mm-hmm.
I will be there. In fact, what I'm going to have painted onto the door is that I'll be open by chance and appointment.
Okay.
But truthfully... when I'm not traveling, when I'm there, I'm usually at the shop anywhere between 40 and 50 hours a week.
Mm-hmm. So you do all of your work out of there now?
Is that
how it is?
Yeah. And I've been dealing in antiquarian books for 24 years now, and mm-hmm. this is the first time I've ever had a public shop. So
how does it feel?
I'm excited. Mm-hmm. I had a quick sort of pop-up store at an art center in San Francisco, the Caddy Start Foundation, in September.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an experiment to see what it would be like to be in a storefront space. And although I hated the commute, it was a really good experience to work away from home.
Uh-huh.
I was able to be a lot more focused. And it's the right time, I think. It also, for me, there's a real importance to doing the store, which is... In general, the antiquarian booksellers in America have become increasingly private and been closing their doors. Partly the market's become global and the books have gotten more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for me to open the store was a bit of a public statement to say that we need to encourage the public to take a look at early printed material to know what a 15th century binding looks like or a 17th mm-hmm. century cookbook, to have a sense of what the book is as an object, as a printed thing, especially during this time when everything's becoming digitized and we're losing a lot of that sense of the book as an object.
Oh, not completely, I hope.
I don't think it'll be complete, but I think that as books become more and more text only, I think that some people will begin to miss what the book is as an object. And in mm-hmm. fact, reading, there's much work on this But reading a book includes an understanding of it as an object. Mm-hmm. If you read a text as a flyer on the street, it's different than if you read it on Kindle. It's different than if you read it in a pigskin binding from the 16th century.
Mm-hmm. Or some kind of binding from the late 20th century.
Absolutely.
And for me, that physical experience is really important.
Yeah.
There's nothing pleasant about curling up in bed at the end of a long day with a computer.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not a plan. I find your eyes get really tired.
Yeah.
I find mine do.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that, you know, the old antiquarian books that I handle were all printed by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And just if you look at type itself that the books were printed from, the body of the type really is a body. It's something that shows wear. It's something that changes over its use as opposed to a computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a life that happens in type that's on the printed page that isn't the same, that isn't really found in an illuminated text.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into this?
Well, I first worked for another bookseller in New York City, and we specialized in antiquarian books on about medicine and science, but really great books like Copernicus first editions, Galileo first editions, Kepler, and so on. And I was responsible for what's called collating his books. So when you buy an antiquarian book, the first thing you have to do is to make sure that the book's in fact complete and hasn't been altered in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what you're buying. You know which edition. Early printed books, there's a certain methodology on how to deal with this, how to assess the book. And so I was hired to what's called kosher his books. When they would come in, I would check for completeness and that they were okay before he would pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did that for 10 years. And he, at one point, encouraged me. He said, I think if you would wanted to go on your own, I think you'd be good at it. I hadn't thought ever to go on my own, partly mm-hmm. because it costs a lot of money to put together the reference library to do your subject and also to get mm-hmm. the inventory together just to open and to issue your first catalog. Also, in the rare book world, it's a bit, it's a very small community. And you either choose to burn the bridges with your mentor when you go on your own,
mm-hmm.
or you choose to keep in good relations. If you go into the same subject, you're going to be in competition
with
your mentor,
yeah.
because there's only so many collectors and so on. So, and you'll compete in the auction room and so on. So I liked my mentor very much. So the early books in gastronomy are almost exclusively written by doctors in the 15th and 16th century, and 17th somewhat also. And so a lot of the reference books, which I was familiar with from working with him, by going into gastronomy, I could still work with them, but it wasn't mm-hmm. strictly in competition
right.
with him. And so that's how I chose. And you have to be excited about the subject you go into.
Mm-hmm.
My mother had written a cookbook when I was growing up.
And yeah, she was up on Sonoma Mountain, right? It was backpacker's healthy recipes
exactly.
for backpackers.
Yeah, it was sort of the first health food backpacking cookbook.
Uh-huh.
It was written in the 70s. It's still in print. Published by the Sierra Club. And so I grew up around, you know, testing recipes, talking about food. And
mm-hmm.
it was before we have the notion of foodie that we have today. But, you know, we're also in Sonoma County and Marin mm-hmm. County. And so everyone, you know, most of us had opinions about food and wine mm-hmm. and so on.
It was good even back then, we weren't necessarily talking about it in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the time of Alice Waters experimenting
yeah,
with what she was bringing in, French cuisine, and in a consideration of local food producers and
mm-hmm.
so on. So it was a good time in Northern mm-hmm. California for
yeah.
food, I think. It hadn't reached the pretension that it has in some ways now,
yeah.
but the products were still being produced, and some people were really focused on it.
Yeah. Speaking of products, you brought a product that we should probably have while we talk.
Yeah, sure. So I brought a bottle of the wine that we served at the opening of the bookstore last night, which is La Follette's Pinot Noir. This is actually from the San Giacomo vineyard, which is on the Sonoma coast from 2010. And La Follette is one of the people who have opened up.
Yeah, he's, I think, the first retail business to open.
Yeah, and I think, I think that they make a very nice California Pinot. We had their Chardonnay as well from the same vineyard from San Giacomo as well last night. And so, I brought this along. I thought it would help pass the hour.
Absolutely. So. And yes, Greg La Follette has been on Mouthful before. I think he does a very nice job.
Yeah, they do. I generally have a hard time with California Pinots, mainly because I like a little bit more acid, a little bit lower alcohol, a little bit more structure.
I like lower alcohol than California's had recently.
Yeah, and I don't like too much extraction in my Pinots, but I think that they do a really nice job.
Cheers. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So at the same time that you are doing your book dealing, you're also doing some food projects that resonate with what you're doing. Let's get into that area.
Right. So the whole time that I've been involved in antiquarian books, I've also been an artist. And I lived in New York for 15, 16 years, was exhibiting with a couple galleries in New York, a couple galleries in Europe as well. And I've always been interested in within contemporary art in general, everyone tends to look at things within a notion of the post-war years. It's a bit myopic, you could say, historically. And the thing I've always enjoyed about working with antiquarian books is that you view things in a much longer period of time. So when you develop cataloging methods, when you talk about the importance of a text or of a manuscript, you're looking at it over 100, maybe 400 or 500 years. And I very much enjoyed working in both art and antiquarian books because it allowed, one really helped feed the other in the sense that to be able to look at art and the production of print and ephemera through my art projects in a longer historical period like I did through antiquarian books, it helped level the field somehow. And in a lot of my art projects, I was doing writing text about my own work, about other people's work, producing flyers and ephemera, and doing these public projects that would usually occur out on the street or in non-art spaces, and that were about what happens when you displace an art discourse into a non-art space, and then what happens when you try to bring that work from the domestic private space into the museum. And the what's happening right now is I have a one-man show at SF MoMA that's up, that's opened in September, and it closes on the 12th of May. And that exhibition actually has three of my project archives. So when I do a project, what comes out of it physically that's exhibited or sold are the archives. And so there's been a traveling retrospective of my work that's been traveling from Europe and through New York and is now in California. In that show at SF MoMA, one of the projects, which I wanted to talk about tonight, one of the projects that is represented is a project called On Becoming Something Else. And that project first occurred with the Pompidou in Paris about 2 years ago. And it's a bit complicated. So I'll tell you two histories of what this crosses over. One is a culinary history and one is an art history story. The art history story is I've always been very interested in artists who, through the pursuit of their art practice, they left the art world. So not where they said, oh, screw the art world, I'm going to be a banker or a truck driver or whatever, but where actually through the pursuit of the subject of their practice, it led them out of the art world. And so in the On Becoming Something Else project, I wrote seven biographical paragraphs. Each paragraph talks about a different artist for whom this happened. So, for example, there was an artist in Amsterdam in the 60s named Hans de Vries. Hans de Vries was making artwork that was about farming, actually, and very connected to Rudolf Steiner and the whole early ideas of permaculture and so on. And Hans de Vries was making these pieces where he was documenting raising these goats, showing the goats at farm fairs and so on, and also documenting the products out of the goat milk and what would happen to them over time. And he would show the documentation in museums and in galleries. Over time, he felt that what happened to the representation of that practice within the art world was inconsistent with the intent of his involvement as a farmer, and he eventually became a farmer and disappeared from the art world entirely. And what I did on this project are these seven paragraphs each have a different heading. So one is the farmer, one is the doctor, one is the psychotherapist, one is the yoga instructor, one is the politician, one is the activist, and so on. So the Pompidou wanted me to do a project with them, and I And so because it was going to happen at an institution, I had to figure out a way that this, not only this idea could work with the institution, but in a way that I would feel comfortable housing it in the context of a group show. So what I did was, with these seven paragraphs, was I then, well, let me back up. In the history of food, beginning in the first images that I'm familiar with that begin in the late 17th century, there's this history of things called pièces montées. And pièces montées are these edible sculptures that chefs would make. They reached their peak in the beginning of the 19th century or mid-19th century with Carême and a French chef named Urbain Dubois. And what they were is a chef would spend sometimes up to 2 months constructing an edible sculpture that might be a classical garden. It might be architectural structures. It might be a monument. It might be an individual. Create a big banquet or a dinner, and then the guests would come and eat the edible sculpture. Mm-hmm. In a few occasions, they would retain the sculptures and take them home as gifts. But usually they were eaten. They were always out of edible materials, often sweet, but by the 19th century, some savory ones were made as well. So this notion of the chef as someone who's involved in recipes and representation is something that interested me greatly. Mm-hmm. And this idea of representing the past and representing an event through an edible sculpture put the chef in the role as a kind of historian, if you will, or and created, one could say, an edible historiography.
Okay.
And this idea of eating the representation of something as a way to talk about what's represented in this participatory experience around the table interested me. So that's the culinary historical part. So what I did is in Paris, and I actually brought I brought the broadside with me tonight to show you. So in Paris, what I did was I didn't want to have this event occur in the institution, so you went to the museum and you picked up this broadside, and there were some other elements of it that were presented in vitrines and stuff in the Pompidou, and you would then go up to restaurants in Paris. And what I had done is I had asked seven different restaurants to write recipes to represent the paragraphs. So for example, here you've got Chef Yves Camdebourg at the Comptoir du Relais, who chose the paragraph on farming, actually the one I mentioned by Hans de Vries. And he then wrote this recipe based on his understanding and a way to represent that paragraph.
Uh-huh.
So you would go from the Pompidou into the restaurant to eat the representation of the paragraph. So they weren't creating pièces montées per se, but they all knew the history of the pièces montées as an example of recipes and representation. Mm-hmm. And the recipe was also intended as an opportunity to kind of pay homage to these artists who had made the decision to leave the art world.
Yeah.
Because art history is usually written by and about those people who have stayed in the art world.
Mm-hmm.
But many times, artists who have left the art world have left it for really good reasons.
On that note, I'm just going to let it ring like a bell. We're going to take a little musical break. You are listening to Mouthful. My very special guest this evening, Ben Kinmont. So this project done with the Pompidou,
yeah,
and seven restaurants in France. I haven't been to France in a really long time, and I'm probably not going for a really long time, and you just make me want to be there.
I would have to say it's my favorite city, so, but I'm not unique in that.
I fell in love with two places,
yeah,
when I was a child.
Mm.
I fell in love with France. I fell in love with France, and I fell in love with a Hawaiian boy. And that has been the duality of my life. And lately, for the last 10 years, I've thrown my lot in with Hawaii.
Okay.
And I'm studying hula.
Oh, nice.
Very seriously.
Wow.
Wow. So
I have to show you. I haven't described it yet, but I have a 19th century Hawaiian cookbook.
I was going to ask you, yeah, if any Hawaiian stuff had come
There's
across
not
your
much.
Desk.
There's
no.
There's not that much. I mean, it's...
And I would assume that had been by the missionaries. Or...
It was very... Yeah. I mean, many of these early state cookbooks are what falls into the genre of community cookbooks.
Yes.
And they're often done as fundraisers for mm-hmm. churches.
I have some from about 1901, 1902, and that's what they are.
Yeah, yeah. And for Hawaii, that's a 19th century one is quite early. I haven't described it yet, so I don't know where it is in the history of the first, relative to the first Hawaiian cookbook, uh-huh. but it's pretty early.
Great. Well, I look forward to seeing that. But let's get back to your project. So you did this in France, and what was the time span?
Well, that's an interesting thing, which is also what the project was very much about. The artists themselves who left the art world were always having to contend with the economy, if you will, of the art world and the mm-hmm. art discourse and that of the other world that they were involved in, whether they were farmers, mm-hmm. social workers, or whatever. Equally, this project, the issue was there's a notion of what's expected through an institution such as the Pompidou mm-hmm. for the duration of a project and what the way that discourse and exchange occurs with magazines, newspapers, the public coming to the Pompidou and so mm-hmm. on. But then this project was situated, the actual meat of the project, if you will, was situated at the restaurant, which has a different economy.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was the price of the dishes was priced according to whatever they would normally have to charge to plate out at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And the length of time that the restaurant could participate, of course, depended upon the restaurant's own menu and its own system. Because each of these recipes were on the restaurant menu without any notification for the public that they were actually eating the representation of another paragraph. And so in some cases, it was on the menu for 2 weeks, I think, was the briefest. In other cases, it was on the menu for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a couple of the restaurants have actually brought back the recipe as well because it was so popular and have continued with it. So people could come into the restaurant and the regular guests to the restaurant could order the food and not know they were participating in a project.
Mm-hmm.
And others went there specifically for it, having taken this broadside from the Pompidou to come mm-hmm. over there.
And so they would just take the broadside, and it would serve as a guide.
Correct. It was like a guide to go around Paris. And there were a couple other elements. There was also there's a famous French anarchist named Félix Fénéon,
mm-hmm.
who there was a group of 30 anarchists in France who were blowing up cafes and found to have bombs, and it's kind of a famous event. And he was one of them, and he later became a well-known editor of a journal in mm-hmm. Paris, and was actually the first one to publish James Joyce. He also became famous because he was an important art historian for Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. At the end of his life, in 1923, Félix Fénéon published an essay called La Plastique Culinaire, which was actually a very early historical essay about the history of the pièce montée.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really nice is in that essay, at the very end, he states, wouldn't we love art more if it were impermanent?
Mm-hmm.
So he makes an argument for ephemerality in contemporary art practices, which is early for that mm-hmm. for that position. And so what I also did was I published the first ever bilingual edition of the Fénéon essay that was printed and distributed at the Pompidou when this project was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I made a bibliography of all of the works that Fénéon mentioned in his essay. I knew them as a bookseller because they're books in the history of food, mm-hmm. and I then borrowed them from the Bibliothèque Nationale and displayed them in a vitrine. So you had the vitrine, which was the culinary history context for the Fénion essay, mm-hmm. which was then the context for the idea of recipes and representation, and then you had this broadside as well, which you would then take and go around to the restaurants. Mm-hmm. So those were all of the different elements that were at the Pompidou.
Remarkable. And now, San Francisco.
Right. So now the show that's at SF MoMA is called Prospectus. And in that exhibition, a couple of my projects have been reactivated. One of them was On Becoming Something Else, which I also reactivated it with some high school kids in San Francisco at Galileo High School, mm-hmm. who created a box of multiples of artworks about the idea of becoming something else. Mm-hmm. And that's on display at MoMA now as well. And then beginning on May 12th, there's 7 restaurants in San Francisco that will be reactivating this project like we did at the Pompidou. Mm-hmm. I'll be printing a new broadside. The broadside will be available at the museum, as well as you can go to the website. It'll be on the homepage for SF MoMA, mm-hmm. and you can go and see the different restaurants that are participating in the project.
And can you tell us who they are?
Yeah, of course. The restaurants are the same chef that I worked with last night for the opening of the party.
Oh, yes.
Leif Heidendahl is participating. He doesn't work with the restaurant. He works doing pop-up secret restaurants, and mm-hmm. so he'll be announcing secret locations that he'll be having his participation. Bar Tartine in mm-hmm. San Francisco, which is Chef Nick Bala and Courtney Burns. Bar Jules, which mm-hmm. is Jessica Boncutter. Rich Food, which is Evan and Sarah Rich. State Bird Provisions, mm-hmm. Which is Stuart Briosa and Nicole Krasinski. Outerlands, which is Brett Cooper, and Camino, which is in Oakland. And they specialize in roasted meats in the fireplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, Outerlands is the one I don't know.
So Outerlands is sort of out towards Ocean Beach area. Mm-hmm. And in Paris, it's, you know, chefs tend to have their crew and their friends that sure. they work with and communicate with. Mm-hmm. In Paris, I worked closely with Inaki at Chateaubriand, and mm-hmm. he helped me to bring in a lot of the other chefs. In this particular case, I worked closely with Liz and Chad at Bar Tartine, mm-hmm. and they helped, and we kind of together brought in all of uh-huh. these various restaurants. And I have my meeting, my first one-on-one meeting with all of the chefs on Tuesday, day after tomorrow.
Oh. So you haven't done that yet.
So, okay. Yeah, they're all committed to the project. Mm-hmm. They've gotten the text, and we just now have to kind of iron out what recipes and which paragraphs they'll take.
Right.
And then I have a letterpress printer in Berkeley named Richard Siebert, who's in the process of putting together the broadside for me.
And then people can go to SF MoMA.
They,
or not. And when they go to MoMA, they buy the broadside?
The broadside will be given away.
Oh.
And we only have so many to give, sure. and then they're gone. But it will be available also at the restaurants. Uh-huh. And anybody can go to the website for SF MoMA.
Sure, you can read it on the website.
Yeah, and the website will have the information about how to participate.
And but part if you want the broadside, I mean, get the broadside and frame it. You know, get the broadside and frame it. It's beautiful.
And if you want the French one, which is bilingual, recto verso, French English, and other broadsides from menus that I have are available at the bookstore, of course,
oh,
as well.
Okay, yeah. Great.
But I don't know how many of your listeners are aware, but SF MoMA, in fact, closes to the public on the 2nd of June.
No.
For 3 years.
I did not know that.
They received a very large donation and are doubling the size of the museum. And as a result, they're going to be beginning new programming that will occur in and around the city itself. And so this project, which I had done with the Pompidou, is perfect for them because it's a project which begins at the museum and then goes out into the city. And mm-hmm. so this is sort of one of the beginning projects for this next stage of SF MoMA. Uh-huh.
Interesting. Well, what a great thing. This is a really juvenile question in a way.
I'm sure it's not, but go ahead.
How did the Pompidou find you?
Well, I'm represented by a gallery in Paris.
Okay.
And so they knew about my work from that.
Okay.
And I'm known for I had done another art project that involved food once before mm-hmm. in Montpellier in 2002.
Yeah, okay.
It called An Exhibition in Your Mouth. And
tell us about that.
So this project not dissimilar to On Becoming Something Else, I was interested in presenting the work of other artists. And in this particular case, artists in the 90s in New York, myself included, were beginning to look again. This is something that comes up periodically with the idea of art and food. And I wanted to organize an exhibition that would provide us with a context to see this as a historical development, to not, again, view it as such a myopic thing that was just a new trend in New mm-hmm. York in the 90s, mm-hmm. but to see that it had, a lot of artists have been interested in this over a long period of time. So I organized this exhibition, and the idea was that there were these artist-written recipes, which started with the Futurists in the beginning of the 20th century and came up all the way, at that point, the recipes and went all the way up to the 70s mm-hmm. with the Fluxus artists. And the idea was that if the artwork created by the artist was a recipe, the only way one could really appreciate the artwork was through eating it, and thereby the exhibition space became your mouth. And so the show was called An Exhibition in Your Mouth. Uh-huh. And it was at the FRAC, which is the FRAC is the system for the different departments in France. Mm-hmm. Each one has a museum. And this was the museum in Montpellier for the Languedoc-Roussillon area. And I actually prepared that dinner for 45 people, I think it was, and there were different recipes, beginning with the Futurists, going mm-hmm. through Marcel Duchamp's steak tartare recipe, Louise Bourgeois' cucumber salad recipe, mm-hmm. a recipe from the restaurant Food, which was created by Gordon Matta-Clark and some collaborators in New York during the 70s, and so on. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I remember when you were doing it, you told me about it mm-hmm. just before you were doing it, but I don't think I haven't seen you in quite a while.
So that project became quite popular and mm-hmm. has since been recreated a total of 4 times.
So in Paris and then?
In Montpellier, in Amsterdam with the Stedelijk Museum, okay. in New York for the Biennale called Performa, and then in San Francisco in September.
Oh, okay.
So each time with a different chef. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is the way in which... So in conceptual art and contemporary art, there's this genre called instruction pieces, which is this idea that an artist writes a series of instructions mm-hmm. and the work gets created. And it's something which sort of began in the 60s in mm-hmm. America and in Europe. And what was interesting to me is the way in which one can view recipes, musical scores, as a form of instruction pieces. Mm-hmm. And in the art world, it tends to be – we get so focused on idea of authorship that the idea of – co-authorship and the evolution of an idea that can exist in music is a little bit harder to talk about in contemporary art because we mm-hmm. focus so heavily on the author. But when we talk about music, we can talk about people's variations on somebody else. We can talk about the difference of one performer's interpretation of a musical score and so on. And of course, with recipes, we can do the same. Mm-hmm. We don't try to maintain that we know exactly how, like the dish that Life cooked the other night, he cooked a recipe from Platina's, the first printed cookbook ever made, the fava bean. You were talking about fava beans earlier. Uh-huh. They're in season now. He did the crostini dish mm-hmm. with the fava beans on it. That actually came from a cookbook from 1475. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we can't maintain that we really know what it tasted like because who knows what those fava beans were like? Who knows the exact measurements were different than we use today, how long they cooked them and so on. But we can do a riff on it. We can interpret it and do it our own way. And I think that for me, I like the idea of blurring the boundary between a recipe and what it does with the notion of authorship, as recipes are mm-hmm. handed down through mother to daughter or through the centuries or however. And I think that I like the idea of blurring the boundary between an instruction piece in contemporary art and mm-hmm. that of a recipe.
Interesting. I'm fascinated by that succession of things, both not just in recipes, but certainly to a large degree in recipes. On that note, we're going to take another musical break here on Mouthful. We'll be right back with more talk with Ben Kinmont. Thank you. You're listening to Mouthful. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for joining us or for sticking with us. My guest, Ben Kinmont of Ben Kinmont Bookseller, just opened in the Barlow. And he has just handed me a card. It is a man sitting at a desk with many things behind him. It looks like some sort of pantry cupboard, a larder, but not really a larder. So tell me what's up.
So that engraving is of a man whose name was Grimaud de la Reynière, and Grimaud is famous for being the first food critic in history. And Grimaud, from 1803 to 1811, published a series of 8 volumes called the Almanach de Gourmand.
Mm-hmm.
And the French Revolution, as many people know, resulted in the restaurant as we know it today. So when the French Revolution occurred in the 18th century, a number of chefs who were working for noble families needed a place to work. And around the Palais Royal and other places, they began to open up restaurants. And before that, the notion that you could have a menu where you had a choice of numerous dishes that the chef would then prepare for you was unheard of. You had the dish of the day if you were working at a tavern or an auberge or for travelers. You sort of had what was available at the time. The restaurant emerged in the end of the 18th century. By the beginning of the 19th century, it was still pretty much a brand new thing. There's famous accounts of people from England traveling to Paris being handed a menu at a restaurant and thinking they're being given a newspaper. It was conceptually so radical that people just didn't know what to do, what they were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Grimaud started out and was first known as a theater critic. And he, while being a theater, he has several volumes written about the theater in the late 18th century in France. While being a theater critic, he falls in love with a theater star who spurns him. Grimaud was also born with a disability. It's believed that his hands were made of wood and due to his disability.
Huh.
And if you see pictures of him, I don't know what the disability might have been, if it could have been something due to the nature of his birth or spina bifida or whatever, but his body is a little bit hunched over. He's got a thick neck. He was described as being small, but because of this loss of this love that he had, he decided to devote himself to writing about food, and he's the first man to do this, and he spurned the theater from that point onward. And this image here, which shows a bookcase or in the back, but it's in fact filled with food, was something that always fascinated me. He was always sort of a hero of mine,
mm-hmm.
Grimaud was. And it's shaped a bit of a pyramid shape. It tapers as it goes up, but it also gets larger. The shelves get larger as they go down. And it sits on these two little pedestal cases, and he's at a desk in front of it with his manuscript in front of him, looking very troubled. And what he's doing is he's trying to write about the food behind him. In the other frontispieces of the books, you see the chefs delivering the food from their restaurants to him. And so what this is the food from the current restaurants around 1803, 1804 in Paris that he's writing about. And what I did for the bookstore, which is something I'd always dreamed of doing if I ever opened a bookstore, was I kind of calculated out, if he was a little bit small in stature, what the length of his shin was. And from that, I calculated the measurements of the bookcase. And I actually had the bookcase fabricated for the bookstore. In fact, it was fabricated by Bertrand Blandina, which is a stair-making company and furniture company that's just down the street here, in fact, on Le Bath, just like
okay. just down the street from the station.
From the station, excuse me, yeah. And so they fabricated it out of walnut for me, and it's the image that I'm using for the bookstore on my stationery. It'll be the sign that hangs outside and mm-hmm. so on. I've handled his manuscripts in the past, and his penmanship is extremely peculiar because of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
The letters don't connect. The O's look more trapezoidal. There are no circles that he made. But he really, really important figure mm-hmm. in the history of food.
Interesting. I have to look at this again. It's the shelf behind him is really fascinating.
So So for the listeners, they can come by the bookstore and see what the shelf looks like.
Yeah,
we've got it there in all of its eccentricities, such as the strange spacing between the shelves, the taper, and everything. So
let's go back to the bookstore now.
Yep.
And who are your customers, your real customers? Who buys from you? Are these global collectors?
Yes.
People who maintain temperature-controlled collections?
Well, I should say that antiquarian books are far more stable and better built than any book we buy today.
Okay.
So they're not that fragile, in fact. I mean, one, they don't like water, for sure.
Sure.
They don't like extreme amounts of heat. It depends on the binding. If it's a vellum binding, then they don't like the heat. Otherwise, the books are quite durable.
Oh, okay.
So the temperature control, humidity control is not really a big issue so much. But I sell a little bit more than 50% of my books to research institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So I sell to Library of Congress, Berkeley, Stanford, the Bibliothèque Nationale, different research institutions around the United States and overseas. I also sell to private collectors, some of whom are in that field. So I have a customer in Vienna whose family for 150 years has made bread making machines, and they're making a bread museum. And so he buys books about bread.
Mm-hmm.
I sell books to viticulturists who are interested in the history of wine. But sometimes it's just somebody who likes food. You know, it doesn't have to be a specialist in the field.
Uh-huh.
And a thing that I try to tell everybody is that one can collect interesting books and ephemera about the history of food and wine without very much money. It's true that great books are very expensive, but there's also material out there that's fascinating that isn't very expensive.
Yeah.
And through making a collection around a given subject, you can contribute something to that field just by paying attention to it and being interested in it.
Yeah. And how do you find your inventory?
I buy at auction. I buy from other dealers. I buy from private people who are looking to sell their collections.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this long enough now that that the dealers in Europe and America know that that's my specialty, and so I get quoted material now.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a generalist, you might buy a collection of 100 books or 1,000 books, and there may be a few good gastronomy books, but you wouldn't necessarily know what their worth and which ones are of interest, and so they'll quote them to me, and so it's kind of, you know, there was a famous bookman in New York City who's no longer alive named Saul Malkin, and before the internet, he used to do this magazine. I think it was called Bookman's Weekly, which would list all of the desiderata, all the books that people were looking for around the United States, and it was everything. I mean, the book that was 20 years old, the book that was 200 years old. And Saul was quoted once as saying that his role was really in just matching the right book to the right collector.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have a collector who is specifically interested in the history of potatoes. And then you might have, you know, somebody else who's interested in women's studies. And they'll look at each text differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so really your role as a bookseller is in introducing them to the right text and letting them helping them be aware of that it exists.
Yeah, and that reminds me of one thing I wanted to ask you, one element. Domestic economy.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about those books.
Right. So domestic economy includes everything from how to go shopping, notions of marketing, what kind of menus to do at different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It includes cookbook, recipes rather. It included things such as domestic remedies, for when people did more of their
home remedies.
Home remedies, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It included things such as how to clean your house and what recipes you needed to clean your linens, to clean an oil painting that got a smudge on it of some sort. But it would also include things on how to run the household in a wise way and keep the budget and so on.
Right. Yeah, because I think, you know, Downton Abbey has gotten very popular, and because of Downton Abbey becoming popular, people have looked back to Upstairs, Downstairs, and those time periods.
Absolutely.
And in one of them, I'm pretty sure it was Downton Abbey, there's the issue of the book. It might have been Upstairs, Downstairs, and it was Hudson's book.
Hmm.
It was Hudson's book where he kept, was his book as the butler. He kept everything, how to remove stains, maintaining the wine cellar, all those details.
Yeah, I have a number of manuscripts like this.
Oh, that gives me chills. I would love to see that information.
And they're very, very special because what happened was, you know, it used to be that history was written about the important people and the important events. Mm-hmm. But then as social history came into play, material culture and so on, we began to look at things like women's studies, private lives, mm-hmm. these histories that were not so visible, let's say, and covered by most of the earlier history books. This change in historiography caused us to also begin to look at these types of domestic economy books. Mm-hmm. And they're really important because they tell what were people really doing, not the upper echelon, but what were they doing
to maintain day-to-day life. It seems to me that those sorts of writings have disappeared. Am I right? In the modern world.
I think that there are some books that are popular that come out that are trying to help people with that, especially now that I think that our economy is struggling. Mm-hmm. I think the notion of like, how do we live in a way where we can not live beyond our means, and how do we, and even I think in agriculture, notions of sustainability
are
not so dissimilar from a lot of the earlier, what's called rural economy books, mm-hmm. where people, like I have German books from the 18th century where people would talk about the ponds that they would have to raise the fish so they would have fish to eat, the mm-hmm. berry gardens, the trees they would plant so that in 30 years they would have the trees to cut down to make the timber to then make the home for the children. This notion of like looking at things in a much larger economy.
Much longer arc.
It was certainly more prevalent earlier on than it is mm-hmm. today. You're absolutely right. But I think that some of those themes are starting to come back.
So maybe in some of the books we're seeing urban farming. You know, the diary, there was a young couple I had who was living in Vallejo, mm-hmm. and they just started this little urban farm in their backyard and wrote a book about it. And so we're seeing a number of those sorts of things.
That's true, yeah.
So maybe that's where we're finding that expression.
Right, and I think people are starting to look at the older books because of that. Mm-hmm. They're starting to see different solutions that people uh-huh. came up with before. Because for a lot of us, this is new. Mm-hmm. We're so accustomed to the global food economy that it's only now with all of the interest in things being more local and eating more mm-hmm. seasonally that we're now thinking, well, maybe we can participate in it more directly ourselves.
Yeah, and that's a good move.
I think so.
I think it's a very good move. What's next for you? You've got your thing happening through MoMA. Do you look that far ahead or...
Right now it was a big step to get the store open.
Yeah.
And I have to say I'm very happy with how it looks, and I really enjoy uh-huh. being there and working there. I think that the next stage is to really get that up and running and to start to welcome the public into mm-hmm. the store, which again is a big stage for me. I mean, the only time I normally interact with the public is during the book fairs mm-hmm. that I participate in. So that'll be a big stage. And then... Then the next kind of round of exhibitions will begin to happen. I have another one-man show coming up in Paris, which will happen next year.
And what's that about?
We'll see. That's still
you don't know
works.
Yet? Are
well,
you to say?
I don't want to talk about it too much in advance. But it'll be with the gallery Air de Paris, where I work with in Paris. And so, mm-hmm. And at this point, I have some various lectures that I have coming up that I have to give. But I try... I find myself as I get a bit older to be more and more partial to working with schools and doing things which are more pedagogic and mm-hmm. working with children or young students. I was teaching graduate school for a while in San Francisco. I've stopped doing that, but I'm still doing workshops occasionally. And I think that it's a nice place in which to experiment with different ideas and to interact with other people. I don't like to have too full of an exhibition schedule mm-hmm. because, truth be told, most of my time is spent with my books mm-hmm. and describing my books.
Yeah. So. Plus, you're a family man.
I'm a family man. Yes, life is about to change. We're moving into a place in the center of Sebastopol.
Right.
So I'm going to be able to walk to work, which I'm very much looking forward to. And it'll be a big change.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit now about people coming to visit you.
Yes.
We've got about 4 minutes left here on Mouthful. So you're open by chance and by appointment.
Since
you're open by appointment, how do people make an appointment?
Well, people can just give me a call. The phone number at the shop is 707 829-8715.
829-8715.
That's right. And or, of course, they can contact me through my website, which is kinmont.com. So, and that's a good way also to get a sense of what type of books we have in the shop. And truthfully, it's totally fine if folks would like to come by just to get a sense of what this type of material is.
Yeah, so people can just come and say,
absolutely,
I heard you and I didn't understand. Show me.
No, it's totally fine
to
come by.
Oh, great.
There's broadsides from some of the menus from the projects we've mentioned.
And would you just, for people who don't know what a broadside is, would you explain that?
Sure. A broadside, in a sense, is not, it's sort of an early poster. A broadside is a single sheet that was printed sometimes in the history of print. They were used as for the news to announce various events that were happening in a given town. Mm-hmm. And I work, I usually am printing broadsides with various letter press printers, mm-hmm. and I've got a number of those available.
And you work with Patrick.
Yeah,
Patrick.
I work with Pat Ray, who is a printer actually in Sebastopol.
In Sebastopol, who's a great world-class printer.
One of the great printers of the United States.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate to have him in Sebastopol.
Now, has he done your most recent catalog?
Yes, he has printed my most recent catalog and printed most of my broadsides.
Mm-hmm.
And
the catalogs themselves are treasures. Oh, do you have one there?
I've actually brought one here for you. So.
Yes. And this is catalog number 13.
And it's actually printed letterpress. And we reproduce a number of the illustrations, woodcuts, and engravings from the old cookbooks.
Yes, and you include recipes.
And I actually include recipes. So it's, in fact, a bookseller catalog that one can cook from. So
here's one. Sheep milk for the elderly. And with a question mark, unrecorded. I love your catalogs. I just love them. They're delightful. And there's a recipe in this one for cranberry sherbet. You can buy a catalog.
Yeah, the catalogs are available for sale at the store. And also if a person just wanted to come and see what an early 18th century book from Paris about beer looks like, or wants to see what a 15th century
an 18th century book about beer.
Yeah. Or I have a book from 1495, which is a poem in Latin and in German that also talks about various courtesies, but including table manners. And that book is the Facetus. So that's also display right now.
You did something with a book about table manners for children, too,
that's
didn't
true.
You?
There was a poem that a colleague of mine had in Latin, a manuscript from 1490 called Specula Mensae, and we actually did a translation of that poem into English, and it's a poem of table manners for children. It's remarkable how much of it I still tell my children. Things really haven't changed. But
yeah, table manners are table manners, and you know, except for the ones about the knife that you have to bring, I think a lot still applies. Well, on that note, the hour went by fast. A little help with La Follette Pinot Noir. Thank you very much for bringing that, and congratulations on opening the location.
Okay,
and
thank you.
You just have to be one of the most fascinating people on the planet. I love what you do. It's just the intersection of so many wonderful things, and it's so totally cerebral and not. Mm. Which is that's a great alchemy. Thanks so much for taking time.
Thank you, Michelle.
Next week here on Mouthful, we will be hearing from Deborah Madison, my interview with her up at Shed a couple of weeks ago. Think we're going to make that happen, Mike?
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. So what will I be doing? I will be at a Great Gatsby party. So, I got the invitation. I couldn't decline. So meet me back here live in the flesh 2 weeks from tonight on another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour.
Oh, she's been there all day.
story. Well, our children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.
Got some beans and good cornbread. Listen to what the preacher says.